Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Minig. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, we'll be going over residential treatment centers. Now, I will just be discussing my experience again with residential treatment centers. And at first, I was a tech at a adolescent treatment center for 2.5 years, so I can go through that process too of what my job responsibilities were regarding intakes and such. And then I will also discuss my experience as a residential treatment center counselor at the facility I work at now. And then I will discuss certain content to the best of my knowledge when it comes to like counselors, job duties, tasks, and referrals, and coordination of care through, again, the lens of a residential counselor like myself. So first off, I would like to get into the intake process because I think that is extremely, extremely important when intaking clients at not just residential treatment centers, but at IOP with lodging, IOP, outpatient, etc. Just to better determine if that client is right for you and your program. So the main steps in doing so involve the process of screening and assessments. Now, there are documentations that help in this that range from initial service plans, comprehensive assessments, and summaries. Then you have the mental health status exam. So that's more observing their demeanor, body posturing, and their speech, vocal levels. Like, do they sound screechy? Do they sound confident? Do they appear delusional? What's their thought process like? Are their thoughts cohesive with one another? Are they rambling on? Are they not sticking to the questions? And so forth. Then you have the telemedicine assessment for client fit. So this is when you would have, let's say, a laptop or a computer at your treatment program that has access to like a camera for like the webcam session, you know. And if a client would choose to do therapy through the computer or whatnot, this assessment is set up to determine if that client is an appropriate fit for, let's say, like telemedicine or webcam therapy. And they ask like basic questions of like level of risk. So if the client is suicidal, homicidal, and again, these are just yes, no answers. And then they ask if the client has any delusions regarding technology, or would they be more distraught, let's say, if you're online and you lose service? Like, would that cause you more emotional pain than it's worth when you're doing telemedicine and just therapy through the webcam? And then you have the Danes admission form. This could either be online or in like a packet. Every treatment center does their process a little differently. So again, DAANES admission. Danes admission is what we call it in the biz. Anyways, again, you get basic information on this. You get like the name, their previous address, phone number, date of birth, age, and then we usually ask for insurance because that's what we bill for. And if they don't, we usually find someone through our administration department or even our peer recovery specialist who will help the client in resources. So this would be a resource, as in health insurance. And then we'll ask them like, hey, you know, do you need opioid replacement therapy? So then we usually take clients to like a methadone clinic or Suboxone, just for dosing, usually every morning. So we ask if they want to be part of that service. And then we ask them a little bit about their criminal history. You know, were they in jail for the past month? Have they been in prison in the past month? And so forth. We'll ask them about their race. And if it's a women's facility, if it even gets into asking them about previous treatment centers. How many treatment centers have they been in their lifetime? They ask about child protection, which again is funny because we ask all these questions again when I or another counselor does the comprehensive assessment. and summaries. So a little redundant, but again, it's all part of the process. Now I would like to move into a different direction that involves another process to the intake. And this has more to do with the client's actual belongings than anything. So when I say belongings, I'm more getting to the fact that clients will do a lot of different things to bring in drugs into the facilities. And there's two points of view on this that I want to get out. And they're going to be different. My first one will be regarding my experience as a technician at a treatment center. And this was back at the adolescent treatment center that I worked at, where the intake process was a little different than it is at the facility I'm at now, amongst others too. So again, not every treatment center does everything the exact same way. Where when I was at the adolescent treatment center, we had a process where, again, we would get the client's bags and stuff and their items, and we'd make more of like an inventory checklist. Which, you know, I really like, because you're going through like all the client's stuff just to make sure he's not or she's not bringing anything dangerous into the facility, like guns, knives, etc. And also, you're looking for drugs, you know, because a lot of times people will try to sneak in drugs in their clothes, their pockets, and so forth. Where the facility I work at now doesn't do that, which I kind of wish they would, but again, that's just not our policy. And it kind of gets into the mind frame too. It's like, okay, if they're going to try to bring drugs into the facility, they're going to bring drugs into the facility. You know, if they don't get it through with this first time with the bags, they're going to find another way to do it. So, but again, going back to my time as a tech, we would do a full inventory of their clothes and their items. And again, we would just do more than just counting the items. We'd get into the pockets and side pockets and etc. just so we can make sure they're not, again, bringing drugs or anything dangerous into the facility. Now, another process we would do would be called a shower-in. And again, many treatment centers don't do this. This could be more of the risk. And the risk will just involve making accusations. So let me get to the actual shower-in process, and then this will all make sense to you all listeners. So you would get in the bathroom with the client, and there would be shower stalls and everything. And as a tech, you know, you would obviously close the door, and it would just be you and the client. And you, again, would have gloves on to, again, protect yourself from germs. And then you would ask the client, you know, to remove a piece of clothing as they were stripping down. So the client would then give me a shirt. I would check the shirt out, make sure nothing's taped to the shirt, and that would be good. Then the client will continue to remove an item of clothing. So then I would check the pants and socks and shoes and everything just to make sure there's no drugs or anything else in there. And then when the client would be down to his underwear, you would tell him to get in the stall. Or he or she, so a female was doing this, female client, same thing, same process. You would then hold up a towel, and then you'd hold it up in front of you, and then the client would then take his underwear off. So during this time, you'd be looking away, and then when he said, okay, it's off, then you would explain, okay, take this towel and hold it 6 to 8 inches in front of your body. So then you'd then give them the towel, and they'd hold it out in front of them, and then you'd ask them, do a 360. So again, when they do the 360, you just scan the body quickly just so they're not taping drugs to themselves to bring inside the facility. So, and yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And I know how some of you listeners can just look at that and think of that possibly as demeaning, barbaric, and so many like negative things you could think about that, especially like the power play and the vulnerability of the client. And I'm sure that's why a lot of treatment centers don't do stuff like this, because of that reason. You know, it could be more traumatic than anything, especially with clients, regardless of adults and adolescents, let's say they have a traumatic history of sexual abuse or whatnot. Well, that could be another traumatic experience for them. You know, they can get into a flashback mode and get re-triggered. I mean, there's so many things that can happen in that situation. And as well as accusations, because you're being put in a tough situation. Even if you are a tech or a worker doing everything right in the most extreme professional manner, you're still in danger of those accusations regardless. Because, again, it's just you and the client in the bathroom, and they're pretty much getting naked for you. You know, so many things can just come out of the woodwork when it comes to that. So it's really important to be just aware of all those issues. So again, that's another reason why maybe some treatment centers don't want to take that chance or risk. You know, who knows? You know, I mean, at the time when I was doing it, you know, I thought like nothing of it. But now that I've been in the field for a few more years and now that I'm a therapist and everything, I just look at it in a much different light than I did as a technician at my first treatment center job, you know, so. Now, again, to be completely honest with you, I still like that to an extent, that process of just, again, you checking to see if they brought any drugs or any dangerous items, because you're actually doing it. You're actually looking at their stuff, their bags. In a sense, it's like an extra line of defense from them bringing possibly dangerous weapons or drugs again into the facility. So, and now from my counselor mindset, recently at work, we just had a client come in for an intake, and we've had this client here before. And let's just say, you know, this client needs a much higher level care than we can provide him. And when we did the inventory, we more so just do the inventory. Oh, it's a shirt. Okay, check. Pair of shorts, check. You know, through my knowledge, you know, the techs do not have to dig in to their pockets and their side bags and whatnot. And just recently, the client was smoking marijuana in the building. And it's hilarious because his excuse was he has a medical marijuana card, when we've told this client multiple times, that's fine, we understand that you have one, but our policy rule states that we do not allow medical marijuana in our facilities, the clients to be using it, it's not appropriate regarding our policy and regulations. And this client's been told this multiple times, yet he still does it. Well, that's either one way or another, but if we would have done a thorough check of his bags and side pockets and clothes and whatever, we would have found the marijuana. So again, that is my argument. The grand scheme of things, when it comes to not just residential treatment, but IOP with lodging, that you really need to check their stuff in a thorough manner. So again, they don't bring in drugs into the facility and start handing it out to other clients. I've been a part of some really dangerous situations when this stuff happens. There's this famous saying in the mental health addiction field where you get a client and you see that they have no motivation to change for the better. And let's say they're here due to probation and everything. Staff members will get to the point where it's like, okay, yeah, fake it till you make it. Or, hey, that's fine if you don't care about your recovery, but then don't ruin it for everyone else. And I feel that if you have people trying to bring in drugs into the facility, that's hindering other clients in their recovery. You know, in a sense, that actually shows what their real motives are. And I've been a part of treatment centers where, let's say, the director sees that situation or hears about it from the primary counselors, and then they'll be like, oh, well, we'll just give them another chance, you know. Maybe they'll change and we'll just frown on that behavior and so forth. And I think that is horrendous poor management. I really do. I get how they want to make money for their treatment centers, their facilities, and we're all about helping people. But honestly, that's a bunch of bullshit to me. Yes, they feel that way. Guess what? I don't. I have never been a part of a situation where a client would get into the facility right away and then they try to smuggle drugs in, or they try to give it to other clients, you know, start selling it. I've never been a part of a situation where that particular client just turned their shit around. You know, oh, they saw the error of their ways of trying to sell drugs into the facility, and they changed and got better and graduated the program. Has that happened before? I don't know. This is how I see it, and this is my lens through my experience. And through my experience, that has never happened. Now, I would like to move on to the next part of my episode, which is the amount of time that is put in residential treatment centers by the client. So again, every facility is different. The one I'm at currently right now is a 60 to 90 day program, again, regarding on the client's behavior and situation. I know other treatment centers that do 6 to 8 months. I've heard of clients being at residential treatment centers for a year. And I'm sure every program has their pros and cons regarding length of stay. Now, for the residential treatment center that I work at, I think we have a good system where they start off with, say, high intensity, or they're beginning their treatment and they're getting used to the rules, the policies, group time, scheduling. So they go through that process for roughly a month, maybe a little bit more. And depending on their behavior and their progress, they will then get transferred to medium intensity if they're doing all the right things. Now, again, when they're in high intensity, they're putting in roughly 30 to 35 hours a week of group and one-on-one sessions with a mental health counselor and their primary substance abuse counselor. Then at medium intensity, their hour requirements get reduced. So some facilities may only have them do 15 hours a week. Some do 20 hours a week, where again, they're still attending groups and getting their hours, but they have the opportunity to get jobs out there, go to more support meetings, NA meetings, AA meetings, other types of support groups, go on passes with their family and friends, you know, getting back into the community. Because in my honest opinion, especially in residential, 90% of the work happens when they're on the outside, when they graduated residential treatment centers. You think of the many variables that they have to encounter. Well, they're going back home into their home environment where you could have some toxic people. You could have old using friends in the neighborhood come by. You have everyday stress, which could be trying to find a job. It could be dealing with stress at the job with coworkers, your boss. It could be having negative interactions with your friends, family members, where you go through that in residential treatment, but then you have people there 24/7, like your fellow peers, staff members, counselors, there to help you out. And again, not saying that you don't have those people on the outside, but again, when you're in residential treatment, they're just there more frequently for you. Just like in all treatment centers and all levels, one of the main things we try to teach our clients are coping tools, like DBT skills, mindful meditation, and taking a deep breath, taking a step back, and thinking, hey, what are some things I could do to help manage these cravings that I'm having? And that could be calling their sponsor, calling a support person, calling a friend, family member, or getting to a place to relax and apply those coping skills to manage those emotions that are causing those cravings. So for the most of that, that will be applied to the client's relapse prevention plan and aftercare planning before they graduate. Then as a counselor, you have to work with your team at the facility as well as other healthcare providers. Let's say if the client had a lawyer, probation officer, case manager, etc., where what will be the best step down for the client? Would it be intensive outpatient with lodging, intensive outpatient? Where is the client going to live? Are they going to live back home? Are they going to live in a sober house, halfway house? Where are they going to be as a location when they leave. I say this because the place they used to live before they came to treatment may not be the best environment for them. Where, let's say, they used to live with their mother, and this client's relationship with their mother is very toxic and abusive, well, that may not be the best place for that client, because that's just a lot more triggers for the client to try to avoid. It would be a situation where they would be put at a high risk for relapse. Now, another point to consider is, yeah, that's life. There's going to be stress. There's going to be moments where you get fed up with the person and you need to learn how to, let's say, deal or manage that situation. Yeah, that's all well and good, but we don't want to put our clients through that type of challenge yet. It's kind of like, you know, when a person just started lifting weights, right? And we start them benching 500 pounds. You know, not saying that they can't do that someday, but right now, they just don't have that capability. So again, we want to put them in the best environment for them to succeed, or at least a higher percentage chance of succeeding. Then throughout time, they're going to learn to develop their tools, you know, their emotional coping tools. It's like sharpening the tools, and the longer you practice your skills, the more you're going to sharpen those tools and the more effective you are going to be at applying them in stressful situations. Which reminds me, I had a previous client tell me that when their mother was trying to become sober and she started her recovery journey, she came to the conclusion that she just can't attend family reunions right now in her life. You know, things like Thanksgiving, Christmas, maybe some birthdays, because she knows at that time in her life and in her recovery that she could not handle, let's say, being around her family members or being around her family members that are drinking or using drugs, because that's what normally went on at those family gatherings. But 3 to 4 years down the road, she felt comfortable with her skills that, hey, I can go to a family reunion or family events and be okay. So some people may look at that as selfish. Well, no, I don't look at that example as selfish. She was doing what was best for her. So yeah, and in a funny way, she was being selfish, like in a good way, because she's taking care of herself. And if she feels she can't go certain places at that time in her life, or she can't go to certain events with her family, then that's that. That's her decision. Interventions. If you find yourself struggling with any type of mental health and addiction issues, please seek the professional care of a licensed medical professional and a licensed mental health therapist. Thank you and have a wonderful day. Bye.